The third case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of John C. Ogilvie Jr. Mr. Ogilvie, you are representing yourself this morning, is that correct, sir?
Yes.
All right. And for the Board of Bar Examiners, we have Craig Eichstead, an Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Ogilvie, you are the petitioner, so you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'd like to thank this honorable court for the opportunity to speak today. In spite of what's been reported to this honorable court, I'm not a liar, and I've never lied during this process. And I'm here because I believe that I've been that it's been wrongfully reported to this court that I've lied under oath. I've made plenty of admissions against my own interest all through this admissions process. And this admissions process has been going on since 1997. And I haven't lied, and I don't lie, and I wouldn't lie, and I didn't lie. This case comes down to credibility. And in this particular case, the board's own witness testified that my accuser was not credible, but yet somehow the board found that she was more credible than I was. The board had hired an investigator, a professional career FBI agent, Lester Davis, to investigate the credibility of the witness and myself, or the petitioner, applicant, from appellant. And that investigator testified that that witness was not credible. I've never committed an act of domestic violence and in my life. And I stand here twice found guilty of committing an act of domestic violence, or at the very least, twice found not being able to prove that I didn't commit an act of domestic violence. Furthermore, the board found that I was an alcohol abuser. I haven't been in a bar since I was suspended from practice over a year ago. Well, I did go into a bar on one occasion, and that was for a wedding reception, and I had one drink. And I don't know what standard was applied to find that I was an alcohol abuser. I believe the board was speculating. Now, I'll admit that I've made some poor choices in choosing girlfriends in the past, and a dating relationship is just that. It's when two people try to find out about each other and learn about each other, and most relationships don't lead to marriage, and I've had plenty of relationships that didn't lead to marriage or lead to much of anything. I was a bachelor for 15 years. But I'm not a bachelor anymore. I'm happily married now.
Has that occurred since the board hearing?
Yes, it has.
Oh, okay.
The standard that was being applied to me, that if somebody's accused of a crime and they claim they're not guilty, and the only way that a negative can be proved is to say under oath, I didn't do it. And if somebody takes the position that I did do it, therefore I'm lying under oath, and because I'm lying under oath, I'm not of good moral character and fitness, that's a standard that I will never be able to pass. I've already been suspended for over a year, and I respectfully ask this honorable court for some opportunity to practice law again in the future.
Are you viewing then a return to the conditional admission criteria? Is that what you're asking for?
I would consider any opportunity.
Okay.
But I wouldn't go back into practice again in the way that I conducted practice before, because I don't have the capital to keep going at that pace for any longer than what I did.
Okay. where, what would you do then?
Well, I'm employed now as a, for ATEC Consulting in Rapid City, which is a point-of-sale business, which would be cash registers, and cash registers today are touchscreen type machines and networked into a back-house computer. I don't want to get into the details, but I'm full-time employed now, and I wouldn't probably have the ability to, anytime soon, to take time off from work to go and practice law, even on a limited basis. Okay. But I would like the opportunity. It closes too many doors to me to be kicked out of the Bar Association. It makes it very difficult to find a job at all. People see your education and background, and they want to know, well, why aren't you doing this? Well, why aren't you doing that? Are you admitted? These are the questions that come up in job interviews, and I've had 100 of them in the last year. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but I've had a lot, 50.
Okay, any other questions from the bench? I didn't mean to cut you off. Had you completed, or is there anything else?
I don't have a lot to say, Your Honor.
Okay.
What went wrong with the mentorship program the first time?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What was wrong? Why didn't the mentorship program work the first time? You had a mentor, didn't you?
I thought the mentorship program did work, Your Honor.
Why are you here today, then?
I'm here today because I was accused of, in my opinion, because I was accused of domestic violence.
Well, the briefs I read had more than just a couple instances of domestic violence.
The board is claiming that I was incompetent in a matter of a case that involved a Dave Schlinker who was in a wheelchair who was hit by a car. And I disagree with the board's position. I think that case has merit. There is no controlling precedent in the state of South Dakota for that case. That case could have gone further. But what happened in that particular case was the damages disappeared. Dave Schlenker got a brand new wheelchair from the VA at no cost, and that would have been the majority extent of the damages in that matter.
But weren't you working with a mentor at that time when you filed that lawsuit?
Yes, I was, Your Honor.
Did you run that by the mentor first?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. And my mentor, in fact, suggested that I should appeal the decision and proceed with it further. But because there was no damages, I didn't want to continue it on.
Okay. Any further questions from the bench? If not, you'll have a chance to respond to Mr. Eichstead after he makes his presentation.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ogilvie. Before Mr. Eichstead speaks, I should note that Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable James Anderson, a circuit judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabres' place. Mr. Eichstead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, after listening to Mr. Ogilvie's argument, I think that it's necessary that the Board of Bar Examiners point out that there's more to it than a mere allegation of domestic abuse. And of course, that may have been what started this matter, but the board looked into this matter with Mr. Ogilvie quite comprehensively. And it's the board's view, after having listened to all the evidence that came out at the fourth hearing in this matter, that there are a number of concerns, and that the board is not accusing Mr. Ogilvie of being a liar. That doesn't appear in the brief. It is, I suppose, in the domestic violence matter of credibility. But Mr. Ogilvie admitted to hitting his former girlfriend. It's just that they had different versions of it, and the board chose to believe the one version. But there are any number of allegations, and before I talk to those a little bit, the board started this after it received information from a number of sources, and even in its notice of hearing prior to the time that the matter went to the fourth hearing, the board indicated that it was going to inquire into the nature and effectiveness of the mentoring relationship, Mr. Ogilvie's compliance with the rules of professional conduct, his timely taking care of his obligations such as tax laws, matters relating to trust accounts, and his conduct in two lawsuits, one of which Mr. Ogilvie mentioned, the Schlenkert matter, but also a matter of Troutman v. Troutman, which was a divorce case where Mr. Ogilvie was representing the former husband. The board held its hearing and made its findings, and of course the board, every time it comes before this court, must acknowledge and recognize that the court's standard of review is de novo, so that the court can look at the record and come to its own conclusions. The fact is, the board heard the live witnesses, and so its conclusions ought to be, at a minimum, subject to careful consideration by the court.
What about this allegation that the investigator Davis, the ex-FBI agent, came to the conclusion that this witness, the ex-girlfriend, was not credible?
I don't know if he said that explicitly, Your Honor, but he did testify to a number of matters that would have impugned her credibility. There's no question about that. And I believe, anyway, that if the board had been looking solely at the domestic abuse matter, the case would have been much closer in their view. Now, they did in their findings resolve the credibility contest between the two of them, but they didn't do so just on the former girlfriend's credibility. Rather, they looked at, particularly in one instance that took place in Mr. Ogilvie's pickup, they looked at the fact that the surrounding circumstances supported better, in their view, the fact that that Mr. Ogilvie threw her against his door, injuring her, rather than the matter of calmness and a safe ride home, as Mr. Ogilvie testified to. But the board did consider those matters. But there were other matters, and I'd just like to briefly go through those to outline them for the court, so that we realize that the court realizes what the board was dealing with here. First of all, I've divided them in the brief and for purposes of this argument into two different groups. Those that Mr. Ogilvie made some attempt at refuting, either in his brief or in his oral argument, and those that he didn't bother to mention, but which nonetheless supported what the board did in calling for the ending of this conditional admission. The first matter is the Jean Heigl matter, and as I indicated, the board resolved the credibility. Granted, there were a number of reasons not to believe Ms. Heigl, but the board also found surrounding circumstances that supported what she said. The Schlenkert lawsuit. This was a matter where the board found that the applicant had sued out the case. This was a matter where a gentleman in a wheelchair had been hit by an elderly lady in a car while he was driving his wheelchair in the dark on the street. Mr. Ogilvie sued that out, but at the time of the hearing, he admitted two things. He admitted, A, he didn't know what he was doing when he sued it out, and he admitted that had he done further research and looked into it a little bit more, he never would have brought the lawsuit. Those were his own admissions, and those are primarily what the board considered when it considered that matter. In the Troutman divorce, Mr. Ogilvie scanned a document from opposing counsel into his computer, made changes, and then had his client sign it, sent it back to opposing counsel, and did not inform opposing counsel that he had made the changes. At a minimum, the board found that that showed poor judgment and not knowing how to relate to opposing counsel.
I get this clear in my head here. When this Troutman stipulation was sent to him, had it already been signed by Ms. Viken's client?
I'm not certain about that. I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it was basically proposed stipulation, but I think it had not been, because I know that Ms. Viken and her client looked at it again after she got it, and if it had been signed, they probably wouldn't have looked at it again. So no, it was a proposal, clearly, but he scanned the proposal and made the document look as though it was the original document, sent it back with no comment. Now, at a minimum, poor judgment, maybe not the most serious allegation, but nonetheless something that Ms. Viken was taken aback by, and she said that in 25 years of practice, she had seen something similar happen only once before. evidence of the applicant's heavy drinking. Once again, the board was relying primarily on his own testimony. There was testimony from Ms. High Eagle indicating larger volumes of alcohol, but the applicant himself testified, as the findings point out, that he drinks beer every day, that he does so at least at the time of the hearing, and maybe things have changed now, but we have no way of knowing that, but that then on a Friday night he'll go to the bar, drink 6 to 8 beers, and in fact, when one board member, Mr. Hall, asked him, when was the last time that you abused alcohol, exact question, his answer was Friday night. This is contained on the hearing transcript 4 at 285 to 86. So these are the ones that the applicant has addressed. Now there's another 5 or 6 items that the board found were not as good conduct as it expected and presumably as the court expected. First, the applicant admitted that he routinely deposits unearned retainers funds and funds that are intended to for filing of filing fees and the like in his personal checking account, not in his trust account. He does this before they're earned. He stated that he used a large, what he referred to as a grease board, I'm assuming we're talking about a whiteboard or a dry chalkboard sort of thing, where he had some information about his client's cases, and this was the board was concerned about confidentiality because this was maintained out in the open where everybody could see it. He admitted that he has on occasion filed sales tax returns that were not on time, believing that if he paid the penalty, that was all the better conduct anyone could expect. He testified that he assisted Jean High Eagle in avoiding her creditors by depositing a $5,000 check from her father made out to her in his trust account with the thought that the creditors wouldn't be able to access it. Now that, he did later deny that he knew that was the purpose, but he did state specifically in the hearing transcript, page 115, that Ms. High Eagle had creditors and that that's why they put the money in his trust account. The board also stated in its findings that the applicant's mentor had been continually available to him without charge and pro bono, and that he had failed to effectively use the mentor as shown by the way he conducted his practice and the cases that the board had previously considered. Now, the board recognizes that some of these allegations are more serious than others, and that some of them may be fairly minor, but what the board was looking at was the totality of the circumstances and the way Mr. Ogilvy had conducted himself during the period of the conditional admission. And the board would state only that it feels strongly that it had a right to expect better conduct than that is shown in the fourth hearing transcript from Mr. Ogilvy on the time of his conditional admission. It was, after all, a sort of probation, and this court recognized, both the majority and Justice Konenkamp in his concurrence, that Mr. Ogilvy was going to, in effect, be under a microscope. The board would be looking at him closely, and he had better conduct himself appropriately. The board feels that he has not, and the board states that it reasonably expected that the conduct would be better than that shown in the fourth hearing transcript. The board therefore continues to ask this court that the conditional admission be revoked. And I would point out, too, that the statutes require that the burden continues to lie with Mr. Ogilvy during the whole time of the conditional admission to show that he is a person of good moral character. The board feels he has not done so and therefore asks that the matter be continued in the present mode, and that the that being that Mr. Hull will be suspended, and that his license be revoked. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eggsted.
Further questions?
Okay. Mr. Ogilvy, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Um, just briefly address what the board is contending now. There was two cases that the board was concerned about, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe I handled 146 different matters in the 2.5 years that I was in practice. As far as the board finding Jean Cohn Heigl more credible than me, the board doesn't know her. The Troutman matter, yes, I did take a document that was sent to me and scan it into my computer and make changes on it, and had my client sign it and send it back to Linda Lee Biken.
Had the draft you received been signed, or is it correct that it was unsigned when you got it?
It was unsigned when I got it, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I had originally made another draft and sent it via fax back to, I scanned it in the same way and sent it via fax back to Ms. Viking. Once I had it scanned, I didn't have to continue to scan it. I could just go into the file and change it anytime I wanted to. It was Ms. Viking's client that was in a big hurry to get things done, and it was Ms. Viking's proposal that ended up being the changes that were in the final stipulation that I had my client sign, that I dropped off at her office without a cover letter. And that was poor judgment on my part to tell her what changes I had made, but I made the changes that she'd suggested or offered.
Wait, you're saying it would have been better to send a cover letter saying, look, I made these changes, you should consider them?
Absolutely.
And you just did, you just forgot to do that? You got in a hurry?
I got in a hurry because it was Ms. Viking's client that was in a big hurry.
What were the changes that you made?
Well, she had offered to pay $30,000 in cash up front to my client as a settlement. And that was the major one that I can recall.
And you did what? You changed
what? I put it in the document that she would pay, that her client would pay my client $30,000 in cash prior to the divorce being settled.
You just added that, you mean?
I did. Because that was my understanding of what upfront meant. But it was apparently a point of contention that she couldn't raise $30,000 until after the divorce was settled. She signed it anyway, and the divorce was settled, and then the $30,000 was paid. There was never a document indicating that it would be the other way around. But that's the way that happened. The board contends that I drink beer daily, and at the time I did. But that was not for the purpose of drinking beer. I was going every day to a certain bar establishment in Rapid City to try to court business. I had represented Abate of South Dakota, and it was a member of Abate, and it was a place where the Abate people went. And so I would go there during the time between maybe 5 and 7 o'clock and meet with people and try to establish a business and try to court new clients. Most of them tend to be contractors. They tend to have a little bit of money. They don't tend to be drunken bums. And I don't think I ever stayed in there past 7 o'clock on any of the occasions that I was in there. If I testified that I went to the bar and had 6 to 8 beers in the bar, I don't recall that testimony, and that doesn't sound like it would be accurate. There was probably 3 occasions that I might have gone to the bar and had 6 to 8 beers in the bar. Oh, I'd have to review the record to see if that's what I said. As far as admitting that I abused alcohol to the board, by the end of the fourth hearing, I thought that having a beer was alcohol abuse. I don't know what the definition of alcohol abuse was going to be. But I did admit that 3 days prior, because I knew I was going to have a hearing before the board, and I knew that at least the chairperson was out to have my license, that I was having trouble sleeping at night, and I would drink beer during that period of time. As far as the matter of depositing unearned funds, I didn't take retainers from clients and then bill by the hour and submit bills. And I rather did things as though I were a contractor, and said, okay, if this is your problem, I'll do this problem for X amount of dollars. I would, initially I asked for half the money up front, and after some period of time in practice, I discovered that that was the only half I was ever going to get. And so as time went by, I was asking for two-thirds of it up front. And in most cases, that's all the money I got. But I probably didn't have six people that paid me in advance the full amount of my fee. So I considered it money earned, and I deposited it in my account, and nobody ever asked me for a refund. So if somebody would have, I probably would have just given it to them. I did maintain a grease board in my office, and it had generic names, Bob, and it had a bunch of numbers written in different colors. And if somebody was good at code cracking, that they could decipher what it meant. But most it wasn't hanging in plain view of where people would sit and confer with me, but rather it was off to the side, and it was something that I would refer to so that at a moment's glance I could tell if I had an appearance tomorrow or something like that. And I don't believe that that board contained information that would breach client confidences. In retrospect, I probably shouldn't have done it. But I came up with the idea when I was in legal services at the University of Wyoming, and I did it there to maintain a client list and know what was going on. And people told me that they thought that was a good idea, that it was a smart idea, and that I knew at a glance what was happening. It was in our office, and our clients didn't come in there, though. So although the other attorneys in the office all saw it, clients didn't see it where at the location that it was at. And so I didn't think about it, that it might be a breach of client confidences if someone came in, because I suppose the janitor might have come in and looked at it. I did file my taxes late on occasion, and I don't have an excuse for that. I know my taxes are due on the 20th. What would happen is that I wouldn't get my books balanced from last month, and then I couldn't file them because I didn't know how much money I'd made, because I didn't set myself a time. I didn't make the first of every month the day that I'm going to do my books for last month so that I'll know what I made and what I paid out. I would write it down as it occurred, and I would keep the ledger, but I wouldn't do all the additions and the subtractions, and I wouldn't break out the tax. So when my tax was due, if I was busy, I didn't have time to sit down and spend 3 hours doing my books from the prior month. And I know that the late fee is only, it's $5 or 10%, and I never had to pay more than $5, so I wasn't even worried about it. I was never more than a few days late on it when I was late. And I did deposit a $5,000 check from Gene Heigl's father into my trust account, and I only later came to believe that it was done to avoid creditors. The reason I did it was so that she could pay her child support immediately so that she could get her driver's license back. And I did it completely in a self-serving way because I didn't want to have to be her chauffeur. And she didn't seem to have a problem that her driver's license was taken away from her. And I was the one that wanted her to have it so that I wouldn't have to be at her beckon. And as far as not making the best utilization of my mentor, that's just simply because they didn't want to bother him. I thought that I knew what I was doing well enough, and then I thought that John doesn't want me to call him every day and interrupt what he's doing. He's a busy lawyer. Beyond that, I don't have anything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I have one question.
Sure.
Strogleby, did you write the brief in this case? You signed it, I know, but did you draft it and write it as well?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Would you say that the briefing that's been done in this case is representative of the quality of legal services that you normally provide?
No, Your Honor.
In what way?
I'm too emotionally attached to this case at the time, especially when I wrote the brief. I've been out of practice now for a year. That brief came, it was written in May or June, I believe. And I was brought rather upset at the time that I wrote the brief, Your Honor.
Any other questions for Mr. Ogilvie from the bench? If not, thank you, Mr. Ogilvie. The court will be in recess.